This is ContraZoom, where we go back and forth about film. I'm your host, Dakota Arsenault. The 42nd edition of the Vancouver International Film Festival hasn't quite closed out at the time of recording, but due to time constraints, we need to discuss some of the films we saw. Coming back to the show to help break down what we watch is Todd Pengelly, who was last heard just two episodes ago previewing the fest. Todd is a critic whose work can be read at the website For Real. Welcome back to the show, Todd. How are you?
I'm great. Happy to be back. I feel like it's been forever since I've been here.
Two episodes is not a very long break for returning guests, so it's nice to have you back so soon.
I'm really happy to be here. We've spent a considerable amount of time together recently, so I kind of feel like there wasn't a break. I don't know where you got the other episode in, but I'm very happy to be back in an official capacity.
I will tell you where the episode happened. I recorded it before we recorded ours. So that's how it all worked out, because I knew I'd be so busy with VIFF that I had Paulo on the show to do our Celebrating Filipino Cinema episode that just came out last week. And I did it a week and a half in advance because I knew I just have no time. So that's why it probably seems like we just recorded yesterday, even though we didn't. But I was going to ask you how your VIFF was going, but you said, you know, you mentioned that you and I were seeing each other a lot during the festival, so I guess it means that your VIFF was just fine?
Yeah, horrible. Terrible. No, it was great. My VIFF has been really good. I'm excited that there's still another weekend left. It's Friday morning at the time of recording, so I still have tonight, and then two more full days, not to mention a pile of screeners that I'm trying to chug through. But it's been a really good festival. The people have really shown out for it too.
Yeah, it's been great. It is sort of funny that we are recording this three full days before the festival is over, which includes the two highest profile films playing, which is The Boy and the Heron and Priscilla. So unfortunately, you won't be able to hear either of our thoughts on that. I won't be able to attend either. I know, Todd, you're going to try to go to the Priscilla screening. I don't know about The Boy and the Heron or not. But yeah, you won't be hearing about them on this episode, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I have tickets for both. I didn't take any chances, so I will be at both.
That's very smart. Very smart. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I agree. I thought this festival was absolutely excellent. It's sort of interesting because, you know, I felt like most of the high profile films this year were ones that were not in English. So most of the movies that we're going to be talking about today are not English language movies, which is very interesting because Priscilla obviously is the big one. And then after that, it seemed just like VIFF didn't get any of the other, you know, big English language films. We didn't get Ferrari or Saltburn or American Fiction or The Holdovers or anything like that. They played at TIFF in Venice and stuff like that, but they didn't come to VIFF. But I did think overall the international lineup was absolutely stacked this year, and I feel like I got a huge head start on the types of movies that are likely going to be in contention at the Oscars for Best International Film.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's funny because kind of looking at my list of films that I've seen at VIFF, only two are English language films, and neither are North American, right? That's The Royal Hotel, which is Australian, and then How to Have Sex, which is a British film. So it feels like a lot of the North American, like, you know, quote unquote Hollywood films haven't, like, didn't show up. And then there's a lot of like small Canadian cinema that did, but yeah, otherwise I was kind of expecting The Holdovers to be in the VIFF lineup, which is not something we talked about before the festival, but it seemed like a very VIFF movie, or seems like, I guess it's not past tense, but yeah, no, it's been a very, very good festival for the international films. Exceptional. Yeah, I would say.
Of all the movies that I saw, so in total, I saw 14 movies during the festival, but I've actually seen 18 in total that played, a few of them that played at Hot Docs and then in Toronto that I got screeners for. The only English language movies I watched were The Royal Hotel, which is Australian, as you said, and the rest were all Canadian films. No American, no Hollywood films at all, which was very surprising to me, but super interesting. How many films did you end up seeing overall? Do you know?
I don't know. That's that number I should have pulled before this podcast.
On the spot here, I know.
The number at the end of the festival will be probably somewhere close to your number, though, about 18 or so. I did not cover hot dogs this year. So, yeah, I'll be fair getting enough. All of those in here at this festival.
So before we get into the movies we did see, VIFF did announce the Canadian prize winners. So I'm going to highlight a couple that were mentioned. Best Canadian film went to Fitting In, the Molly McGlynn film, which I watched and is quite excellent, a great coming-of-age story about a girl with a unique medical condition where she was born without a uterus. And so it is a teenage girl trying to navigate the world of her body and her sexuality when it's not what everyone else's bodies is like. So a very, very excellent film and one very much worth checking out. And then Best BC Film went to Wapake, which is also going to be playing at Imaginative, which I'm going to be covering at the end of October. So hopefully I'll be able to watch it and talk about it then. So I want to highlight that. And then the runner-up for Best BC Film was, I don't know how to pronounce it, ASOG, which was also the runner-up for Best Canadian Documentary, which I know Thomas Stoneham Judge went and saw and did an interview, which you'll be able to find on thisisforreal.com, the website that you work for. Those are the most notable Canadian films to win awards. I'll link to the full list in the show notes as well. But let's get started talking about. We're going to talk about five films today, and maybe throw out a couple honorable mentions of stuff we like. Figure this is going to be a good place for discussion. Some of these movies I think are going to be a little tricky to talk about without spoiling, and I really don't want to spoil because for the most part, a lot of people have not seen them, because unless you're at either TIFF or VIFF, you probably have not seen most of these, and they will eventually come out. But so we'll do our best not to fully spoil them. One of them I think is going to be very hard to talk about without spoiling, but the first one is Anatomy of a Fall. When Samuel is found dead outside his alpine cabin, it's clear he plunged from the attic window. But did he jump, or was he pushed? The physical evidence is inconclusive, but the widow, Sandra, looks eminently suspicious to the French authorities. She's a prickly German novelist, and there is a recording of a violent argument she had with Samuel just the day before his death. The only other witness who might shed some light on the case is the couple's visually impaired 10-year-old son. But as the trial proceeds, his faith in his mom's innocence is shaken. So this was a pretty high-profile film for VIFF to get. It did win the Palme d'Or at Cannes earlier this year, and so I know when we went to go see it, we managed to luck out that we were already in the Vancouver Playhouse Theater, but apparently it was an absolute zoo outside of people trying to get in because tickets were so hard to come by. So I'm really happy I managed to get it. But that said, all this hype for me, I feel like it was a bit of a disappointment overall. I'm still not totally sure how I feel about it. It just wasn't the movie I was expecting. What about you, Todd? What were your thoughts on the film?
Well, I'll begin by saying I saw it at a different screening than you. I played twice. Sure. I saw it at its second screening. I was not there for the first one, so I cannot attest to the madhouse that it might have been outside, but I can tell you at the second one, it was quite raucous for people trying to get in. So, I think this was one of the hottest tickets, and probably, I would imagine, the top four hottest tickets for VIFF. Behind Priscilla, Boy and the Heron, and possibly Zone of Interest. I guess we'll get to that later. But it's the single showing of Zone of Interest made it, you know, a hot commodity. I think I'm similar in my reception of Anatomy of a Fall to you. I think I liked it a tad more. Yeah, I'm not totally sure how I feel about it. There are certain aspects I know very definitively how I feel, but as a whole, I think I'm on the fence still.
Yeah, like there's no denying that Sandra Hüller, who's the lead actress in this film, who plays Sandra as well, is absolutely phenomenal. She gives a great performance, and especially since it's a trilingual performance, she acts in German, French, and in English. She's really good. And I love the setup for this. It's so interesting because, you know, we sort of see the incident of what happens right before her husband dies. And then we sort of see it play out. And then I would say almost 3/4 of the movie is actually the trial about his death, because very quickly the French authorities have questions about, you know, how did he die? They think he fell from the balcony, whereas Sandra believes that he fell from their attic. And then there's, you know, this blood splatter that comes up that, you know, casts some doubt whether or not he was pushed or whether he jumped, all this sort of stuff. And so I was really expecting this, you know, more of a whodunit. And it ended up being more of a critique on the French justice system in a way that I wasn't really expecting. And like, it's tough because, you know, the methods that this French prosecutor uses is a little bit questionable, but at the same time, you know, if you are a prosecutor and you have reason to believe that someone committed murder, you kind of have to go at it with everything you have, regardless of whether or not you are quote unquote hurting the person's feelings. And so I think a lot of people are going to be watching this and be like, how can they possibly be doing this to Sandra? Where we as viewers don't actually know what happened. It's left intentionally vague when the death happens. And it's not until the very end that we know the answer. I still believe it's a little ambiguous, even if, you know, you can say, well, the movie tells you this is what happened. I still think there's a little bit of ambiguity to it. But how did you sort of react to the, not necessarily it being portrayed as a whodunit in the lead up, but end up being more of a procedural critique on the justice system?
I'm a big sucker for courtroom dramas. That was kind of directly in my wheelhouse, which actually may be where I just got the edge on you in terms of, I think, enjoying it a bit more. That being said, the pacing is good. I think it's a touch over long. It's well paced though, so that's not like the end of the world. I would say that if the performances were worse, the courtroom procedural of it all would not work for me. But because there's such a powerhouse performance at the center of this movie, which is like the most cliche thing to say, but is very true in this case. Sandra Hüller is just unbelievable. And because she is so good, not to mention the two men who play the kind of lead attorneys on either side, as well as the child actor in this film who plays her son, Daniel, who you see taking in this information throughout the whole film, but especially in those courtroom scenes, it cuts to him. I think that makes it just a really like an actor's showcase. And so there's a lot of ideas being exchanged in those courtrooms, a lot of between the filmmaker and it and the audience and us. There is a huge exchange of ideas in terms of, yes, critique of the criminal justice system, but also what is and is not a relationship, right? What constitutes part of a relationship and whether just a slice of a relationship is representative of the whole, and power dynamics and what fiction means in relation to reality and all of these things, right? There's these very weighty ideas kind of at the heart of this film that are being conveyed. And I think they're being conveyed well because of who is on screen doing it. There are other parts of the film that don't work for me as well. There's a questionable kind of B plot between Sandra and her lawyer that I'm not a huge fan of. There is, I wasn't a huge fan of the almost like at times mockumentary-esque cinematography that was going on. That I found very detracting and felt like it was almost trying a little, it almost felt as if Justine, the filmmaker, wasn't super confident in the moments of like levity and humor, because there are like plenty of moments that are cut with humor to cut the tension, and I think they are funny, but it felt then they were like exacerbated by this kind of strange cinematography choice. And so there were definitely like there were certain things that took me out of it a little bit. But when those things weren't happening, when it was kind of just Sandra Hüller just the child, just kind of, and them going toe to toe and just acting. I thought it was a very, very good movie and fully entranced. I was fully entranced in it.
Yeah, I think I have the same qualms that you have with issues of this movie. And I think chief among them is the, I guess it would be the cinematography, because I don't know if it's the direction or the cinematography or the combination of the two, specifically in the trial scenes, because, you know, it's inferred that this trial is being televised, so everyone in the public is sort of aware about it. And so it's sort of a bit of a plot point where the son has been watching the entire trial, rather listening, because his vision isn't very strong. And the judge wants him to not be in the courtroom for his mother's cross-examination. He says, what does it matter? I'm going to be able to see it on TV. I'm going to be able to read about it. I'm going to hear everything that happens anyways. So you might as well just let me stay here. And so the judge sort of relents. And so we get the cinematography that I'm guessing is supposed to be, you know, the news stations covering the trial, but it isn't. They don't fully commit to it. And so that sort of is what sort of, I think, throws me off a little bit, because you've got these, like, you know, very beautiful cinematic shots of, you know, covering Sandra's expressions and reactions to the different testimonies and things like that. And then you also cross cut it with these very jarring camera movements that make no sense, where it seems like almost like it's, you know, either a drunk person or a beginner who's never filmed something before, and like these crazy whip pans. Or at one point in the movie, there is this punch zoom in on the judge's face, and it was just,
yeah, random. It wasn't even like,
yeah, it wasn't even like it was like this, like, oh, a moment of shock. Look, it was just revealed. Punch zoom. What is the judge's reaction? It was just like a random punch zoom into the judge's face, and it was so out of place. My audience laughed at it. I don't know if your audience experienced the same thing, but it was like a, what was that sort of laughter? And that was like the most noticeable one, but like I could have clocked at least four or five times where there was these really weird camera choices, which just sort of takes you on. You were like, what was the point of that? What are you doing that for? But because they didn't fully commit to this, I don't know, this unseen journalist filming the courtroom versus the actual cinematic shot, you kind of have to commit to one or the other fully if you want to make this sort of mockumentary style work, if that's what your goal was. So the fact that they're cutting between the two styles and it came at very weird, inappropriate moments that didn't suit, you know, revelations or things like that, that's what really sort of took me out the most.
Yeah, I agree. That I was thinking exactly of that, the shot of the judge where It was so strange. It also got a big laugh reaction from my audience. But yeah, it felt very misplaced. Feels super misplaced. In a movie where I think there is enough that's kind of off-putting is not the right word, but distinct in and of itself, that it didn't need that. And for example, kind of one of the big motifs of the film, if that's even the correct word for it, is the instrumental to 50 Cent's Pimp, which I thought was a pretty phenomenal music choice, because that beat starts the first, like, I don't know, 90 seconds of the film. I'm not spoiling anything here. It's being played quite loudly in the home when the alleged crime takes place. And when it started playing, I was like ready. I was like, oh, great. We're playing 50 Cent in this movie. I didn't know this was happening. I was like ready there lyrically. And then the lyrics never came in. And it's just the instrumental. And it is something that came up time and time again in the movie, because it was so integral to the circumstances of the death, that I thought this was like, it was such a unique thing that you would have never expected that to make it into this film. If I was like, yeah, there's a courtroom drama about an alleged murder, almost 3 hours long, French film, won the Palme d'Or, you would not be like, I bet there's a 50 Cent cover in it or instrumental in it. But there is, and it's something that's really distinct and I think does kind of add a charm and humor to the film itself. But also, it's then kind of strangely balanced out by the other weird choices that we were just talking about, where it's like, I don't, like, it seemed like she didn't feel confident necessarily, maybe in the in those characteristics and in those choices, those stylistic choices, and so therefore went a little overboard at times.
Yeah. And, like, I feel like I want to talk about this movie with someone who absolutely adored it because, you know, I look at the Letterboxd ratings that our group that were kind of all going to these movies, and I was in the theater with a bunch of them, and everyone kind of was giving it, like, 3.5 stars. We're like, yeah, it's a fine movie, it's good, but, like, nothing more than that. And so I'm, you know, I really want to hear from someone that was fully on board with it and maybe see if I was missing something, because it just didn't sort of click with me. And even the ending where I mentioned earlier, I'm not going to reveal what it is. There's a slight sense of ambiguity, but not enough to make it truly ambiguous. And it's just like the same sort of thing where, like, I kind of want you to commit to either the ambiguity or the proper resolution one way or another. And this way we sort of get the proper resolution, but it's almost like a little bit of like, maybe it's not actually what happened. I don't know. This is what happened, but I'm not going to say, I don't know. And so it's just sort of this weird sort of in between where she really wants to have her cake and eat it too for a bunch of aspects of this movie. And I guess that's not why I'm fully on board. Without spoiling the ending, did it work for you, or do you sort of have similar issues that I experienced?
I have similar issues, and that's coming from someone who I think I was the highest on it of, like, our group of kind of PNW critics and festival goers in this case. I was definitely between a 3.5 to 4 star rating, and, like, kind of, I mean, like, right in between there. And I leaned 4 because there's phenomenal dog acting in this movie. Like, some of the best animal acting you will see. And so, yeah, I leaned 4. And a lot of that dog acting kind of comes in the second half of the movie in particular, as the movie starts to focus quite a lot on the witnesses of the quote unquote witnesses, right, of the alleged crime, which are just the boy and the dog. Those are the only other people at the residence. So yeah, the ending I wasn't the biggest fan in the world of, and I think mostly because I kind of saw it coming. I was just kind of like, I think I know where they're going to take this, and then they took it there. I was like, okay, well, that's fine. It's well executed, but it's not the most imaginative thing in the world, I think.
Yeah. All right. Well, let us move on to the next film, and that is The Promised Land. The poor soldier Ludwig Kallen arrives in 1755 on the barren Jutland Heath with a single goal: to follow the king's call to cultivate the land and thereby achieve wealth and honor himself. But Kallen quickly makes an enemy, the merciless landowner, Frederick de Schinkel, who is the sole ruler of the area, believes that the heath belongs to him and not the king. Now, in this little preview there, it does not say that this movie is a Danish film. It takes place in Denmark. It stars Mads Mikkelsen, the great Danish actor, and directed by Nicolaj Arcel, who the two previously worked together on A Royal Affair. And Arcel also wrote Riders of Justice, which Mikkelsen acts in. Yeah. So definitely a sort of a lead. Yeah. He didn't direct it, but he wrote it. But this is definitely a legendary, you know, Danish pairing between the two of them. I really like this film, and I thought it was really interesting. We get this beautiful period drama of, you know, Mads Mikkelsen trying to grow crops in this very barren area of Denmark that is sort of the king's pet project of what he wants to use for expansion. But as enjoyable as it is, I don't think it crosses into the truly great threshold. It sort of feels like your very typical period piece drama, one that we've seen tons of times before in English and in other languages. But that said, it's beautifully shot, beautifully acted. Everything about this is very competent. I have almost no notes about things that I can, like, actually criticize about. It just doesn't cross into the threshold of greatness for me. So I'm sort of curious where it landed for you.
Landed pretty much exactly the same place here. I'm hoping there's a movie that maybe I'll just pivot and completely be like, I hated an upcoming movie, so that we have, like, some real friction on the podcast. But no, I was exactly the same way. Kind of, you get 30 minutes into this movie, and And I was like, yeah, I know exactly where this is going to go. Like, there is not, mm-hmm. I wasn't prepared to be super shocked by anything. It's very competently made. Mads Mikkelsen and Amanda Collin are both phenomenal. The fact that the filmmaker is also connected to Riders of Justice doesn't surprise me at all. Like, because that's what I was thinking the whole time I was watching this movie. Was like, wow, you know what people should be watching? Riders of Justice. So another fantastic action vehicle for Mads Mikkelsen. Yeah, I thought this was a very competently made movie, a very enjoyable movie. Not a movie I think I'm going to be returning to in my mind very often as being like, wow, you know what movie really stuck with me? The Promised Land. Which, for better or for worse, I do think Anatomy of a Fall will do.
Yeah, I agree with that because, you know, at least Anatomy of a Fall, it's sort of, you know, playing with these ideas of that you're talking about what constitutes a relationship and the power dynamics and all these sort of really interesting conflicting questions, where Promised Land is very much a just a sort of a typical paint by numbers historical drama. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's sort of a shame because Mads Mikkelsen is one of the best working actors today. And it always sort of seems that like his Hollywood stuff, while he's good in it, never does him quite justice. His best work has always been in Denmark, whether it's, you know, The Hunt, Another Round, Riders of Justice, or Royal Affair. And you know, this is no, I'm not disparaging his performance either, because he's also very good in this, where, you know, he sets out of being this, you know, very stubborn, you know, poor soldier who is bound and determined to cultivate this land that no one's been able to cultivate. And he has this, you know, secret in his head that he's going to be the one that unlocks it. And he's going to, you know, do whatever it takes necessary, no matter who he hurts, you know, who he screws over, all this sort of thing, to get what he wants to, you know, be rewarded for his victories. And then eventually along the way, he learns some lessons, learns that he can't screw over everyone, and he has people that he has to have by his side, and he feels regret and grief, and then he works and, you know, redeems himself. It's a very, very typical, you know, story arc that we've seen 100 times. So it's sort of interesting. Had you seen The Royal Affair before?
I have not seen The Royal Affair, no.
Okay, it's very excellent. It's, you know, like I said, it's the same director, Nicolas Jarcel. Mads Mikkelsen is also in it. It was actually the first time that I had seen Alicia Vikander, because she's in it as well. And it's sort of interesting because it's also a Danish period film. And it sort of involves like this Nordic love triangle as well, because, you know, in The Promised Land, it's sort of a love triangle, although it's a more of a love quadrangle. But basically in The Promised Land, you've got Mads Mikkelsen's character and then Amanda Collin, who sort of plays the wife of a peasant who's working for them. And then, unfortunately, minor spoiler alert, he does end up dying pretty early on, and so she ends up starting a relationship with Mads. And then there is I don't know if she's a princess or someone with a noble title, played by Christine Kuljath Thorpe, who plays a Norwegian noble who is engaged to the local landowner, Deschinkel, who she is not in love with, but ends up falling in love with Mads Mikkelsen. So you sort of have two women that are in love with Mads Mikkelsen. In The Promised Land, in The Royal Affair, it's about the king of Denmark and his Swedish wife, who's played by Alicia Vikander, but the king has gone mad. And Mads Mikkelsen, I believe, is like her consort or something like that. And she ends up he is the doctor for the king. And so the queen ends up falling in love with Mads Mikkelsen. So you have this other triangle, love triangle as well. So it felt very similar of like sort of the themes that Arcel and Mikkelsen were exploring to The Royal Affair. And I feel like The Royal Affair was far superior to The Promised Land, even if The Promised Land has some truly gorgeous cinematography in it.
Yeah, beautiful camera work in this movie. I will have to check out that film because, like I said, I did enjoy The Promised Land, so it wasn't like I'm never going to watch anything that Arcel ever makes after or has made. So I'll definitely check it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a really beautiful sequence when they've got a bunch of farmers who have agreed to work on this land, and they have to basically cut away all the top layer brush, but then they have to burn the land because these roots go so deep, and so they need to burn them out in order to make the ground eligible to be sowed, basically. So it's very beautiful shots of like nighttime, and you know, there's these rings of fire all around Mads, and he's sort of just standing there watching everyone work in the flames. Beautiful, beautiful sequence. And then of course there's some really tough to watch scenes of torture and things like that, but they're shot so well and you feel so visceral when you're watching it. So yeah, great camera work. You know, compared to Anatomy of a Fall, where that was one of our biggest complaints there. But yeah, I agree. Amanda Collin, you know, almost steals the show for Mads Mikkelsen, but I also really liked the other woman in it as well, Christine Thorpe, who played the Norwegian royalty, whatever she was.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of the actor Simon Benbjerg, who plays Frederick Schinkel, who it's really funny. So I made a joke when I was talking about the movie. I called him Frederick Schinkel, and then I corrected myself to Schinkel. The first time Mikkelsen meets him, he addresses him, "Oh, Mr. Schinkel." He goes, "Oh, no, that was my father. I've actually changed my name to Duschinkel because it sounds more royal." And then throughout the whole movie, Mads Mikkelsen keeps calling him Schinkel, and every time he's always like, "Duschinkel, Duschinkel." It's just like a great running joke throughout the film, and he's someone that like is so good at someone you can hate.
Yeah, he's really good. He reminded me a lot of Bill Skarsgård in John Wick 4 from earlier this year, where it's just a really like almost a caricature of like a palpably evil person. And in this case, they're both kind of royalty. I believe Bill Skarsgård's character was French, though, in John Wick 4, if I recall correctly. But yeah, he's fantastic. I don't know. Like, he's just a real, like, it's always tough. One of those roles is always tough, I think, for actors, because it doesn't matter how well you play the role, you're being a true villain, and like, people are going to hate you. So kind of the more hateable the character is, I think the higher the kudos to the actor, because he did a phenomenal job. I hated that guy. So great work by him. I hope that his performance doesn't get swept under the rug because he was so evil and everyone else holds their own, because I thought he was a comically evil villain in this movie.
Yeah, that's always sort of something that I feel like people have troubles with discussing, because, you know, if you have a villain who has got like shades of gray in them where it's like, ooh, I understand their motivations, even if I don't like their actions, you know, it's easy to, you know, give them an Oscar or whatever. But if someone who's just like straight out and out evil, there's no redeeming qualities for them. Even, you know, this person's own subjects who are their closest confidants, even they are like, oh man, this guy's going too far. He's not going to listen to me. I can't stop him. All that sort of stuff. It's really hard for people to like give credit where credit is due. And it's like, yeah, that performance was really strong. You know, I didn't like him, but you know, that's what it was. And so I feel like some people just have that mental block in their head where it's like, well, I can't praise a performance if they have no redeeming qualities in them. There's nothing good to them. So that's sort of, I think, a bit of a tricky area. And I'm not going to totally talk about what happened, but there's a scene where he sort of gets a bit of comeuppance, and in the screening, there was a loud cheer from the audience where it was pretty funny that everyone was clapping along for this guy getting a bit of comeuppance.
Yeah, that was pretty rapturous.
All right. So moving on, the next film I want to talk about is The Royal Hotel. Hannah is backpacking across Australia with her best friend Liv. Running low on funds, they decide that a job tending bar in an outback mining town might be a lark. The job comes with free lodging, after all, and not a little booze. The owner, Billy, does his best to keep the rowdy regulars in order, but then again, he's always drunk himself. Beer culture in a place like this is always going to be a wild ride, but the young women have no idea just how quickly the bottom can drop out of their world. So this was the first movie that I saw in theaters. Actually, it was the first night. I saw something beforehand. I can't remember. VIF is all a blur. But you and I saw this on the first night of the festival. And I was so happy that this movie is great. We're both fans of the film The Assistant. Kitty Green, the director, that was her previous film, and we talked about it on our preview episode. And it was nice to see that while she was exploring very similar themes, I didn't feel like she was just remaking The Assistant in Australia. It was wildly different, to the point where I was quite surprised by the amount of humor in this film, especially in the first, first half or so. There's quite a bit of funny moment, even if, you know, it's a bit of crude humor at times. There's a bit of levity and some nice, you know, release valves for this movie where you can clearly see where the tension is building up to. I know you were a big fan of this. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was a big fan of this. It was a really good way to start off VIF this year. You and I side by side, kind of going through the ups and then mostly downs of this movie. It's definitely not a romp, not a fun time, but a very, very well-made movie. And Julia Garner and Jessica Henwick and Toby Wallace, actually, who kind of plays the lead man in the movie, for lack of a better term, those three are just fantastic. They're very good in this movie. And Kitty Green has it. I mean, whatever it is, she has it.
Yeah, it features a lot of really strong performances. I also, it's tough because, like, I always want to highlight Hugo Weaving, but, you know, he maybe has, like, the sixth or seventh most screen time out of everyone. And so you kind of have to talk about everyone else before you get to him. But it's so nice that, like, Hugo Weaving, sort of in this point of his career, he never had these, like, you know, the leading man looks, but he was always sort of handsome and good looking enough, but he had a bit of, like, slime to his look that he would often play, you know, villains like in The Matrix and stuff like that. But, you know, he's so good in the Lord of the Rings trilogy or V for Vendetta or stuff like that, where because he kind of had a bit of a leading man charm to him, I almost feel like he was not miscast, but not cast to fully show his range. And he's now at this stage of his career where he's not quite an elder statesman, but he's a little bit older in this role. He's balding. He's got this big bushy beard. He's overweight. He's drunk all the time. And he gives this type of supporting performance that you need someone that has the sort of gravitas that Hugo Weaving has and that not a lot of actors can have, where he's not this huge imposing physical guy, but he has the power in, you know, just his voice and just a look that he can, you know, silence the bar of all the rowdy drunks and keep them in check. But, you know, because he's too drunk, it often slips away and he isn't able to stay focused and or is passed out in his trailer or things like that, where we get this really interesting dynamic. And so, like, I just really want to shout out Hugo Weaving because I feel like I'm not going to be able to talk about his performance enough because it's going to be overshadowed by the greatness of Julia Garner and Jessica Henwick.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no love lost between me and Hugo Weaving. He's fantastic. And very good in this movie, too. I mean, he is very good in this movie. It's one of those things, though, where it's like, I felt like you could tell that they had to really parse out his screen time because he is such a commanding presence and he just steals every scene he's in, which is not, like, groundbreaking news. Hugo Weaving, amazing actor. But, yeah, it's, you know, he is great.
Mm-hmm. I also really like the dynamic between Garner and Henwick. The two of them offer enough differences where you can clearly tell that they're good friends. But, you know, you've got Julia Garner at the start of the movie. She's, you know, making out with this guy on this party boat. But then as the movie progresses, we sort of realize that she's actually the much more reserved person and, you know, has a more acute sense of her awareness, whereas Jessica Henwick's character is much more of a flirt and, you know, wants to just go where the fun goes and sort of believes in the best of everyone. So they play off each other really well because there's some moments where they're arguing about whether or not the place that they're staying in is safe or not. And Jessica Henwick's Liv is like, no, you know what? We're fine. Nothing has happened. You're overreacting. Like, what's going on? And so I feel like most of the movie's perspective is from Julia Garner's character. it would be sort of interesting if we maybe saw a bit more from Jessica Henwick's character, because every scene we see, you know, as a viewer, we're like, ooh, this is a dangerous situation. Be careful what you say. Don't talk to that person. Ooh, don't get too drunk. Watch what you do with your drink. All that sort of stuff. We're like, as an audience, you know, our antennas are up at full blast, kind of like Julia Garner's is. But I do appreciate the differences between the two women, how they're still able to be friends despite their differences in outlooks.
Absolutely. And they just have really good chemistry. I think this comes down to, we talked about this on our preview podcast, of our kind of excitement to see Garner and Henwick working together as two overly competent, I would say, if not very, very, very good in every role they're in, actresses. So, and this as like a kind of two-hander, and it is very much a two-hander, even though the character is on very different wavelengths. And so I think Henwick is especially great in her definitely like more minor role. She has less screen time. She kind of gets less emotional depth, all of that. But she's just as good. She's fantastic. And because of their balanced chemistry, you never lose the sense of like waiting for the other shoe to drop, that the audience and seemingly Julia Garner's character are like sitting there waiting. They're like waiting for the other shoe to drop. And Henwick brings a level of playfulness to the movie that is terrifying. Like that's why the waiting for the shoe to drop is so scary, because it's like, no, 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 please don't do this. And Yeah, Henwick is great. Garner is amazing. I can't sing their praises enough, nor Kitty Green's, for kind of hitting it out of the park twice in a row for her first two films.
Yeah, it's funny. We were watching this film, and as I mentioned at the beginning of this movie, Julia Garner's character is making out with this guy on this party boat, and we don't really see him. It's inside of a dark nightclub. And then when they're outside on top of the boat's deck, it's kind of a far away. We don't really think much about it. And then he shows up later in the film. And I love how you and I literally turn to each other and like point at each other and be like, hey, we recognize that guy, because it turned out It was Herbert Nordrum, which is a name probably not going to ring any bells for people, but he was in The Worst Person in the World, one of the best movies of the last few years, as one of the love interests for the main character, the Julie character. So it was sort of funny to see him pop up in a very, very small part, but it was just one of those moments where it was like, hey, we both know exactly who this guy is.
Yeah, he was having the time of his life on this set. Which is hilarious, because this movie is definitely darker than The Worst Person in the World. Not just one of, I think, probably the best movie of the last few years, Dakota. Understatement. But yeah, really great. I loved watching him pop up.
Well, we do know that you are a Hamaguchi hater, and that was the same year as Drive My Car, so you know.
the worst movie of the last few years.
No, The Worst Person in the World. Is that what you meant, right?
Is Ryosuke Hamaguchi, yeah.
We're now getting very deep into some inside joke territory. Do you have any last things you wanna talk about the Royal Hotel, or are you good to move on?
See it. Try to see it in theaters. The assistant was really done a disservice for being a COVID movie, and Kitty Green and Julia Garner, as her kind of De Niro, deserve their time in the sun. So I hope people go and see this movie. I hope it's made available to see.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a bit of an easier sell for people to watch. While I love The Assistant, it's by no means an easy watch. And at least with The Royal Hotel, as uneasy as some of the subject matter is, you sort of get... you get the ending that you would hope for in a movie like this. And it feels good to watch. And so you can walk away from this movie being like, yeah, it was a bit hard to watch at points of it, but you know what? I really liked what they did with it. So I think it's probably going to have a bit broader appeal compared to The Assistant, mm-hmm. which was, you know, a pretty dark movie that ends on a very morally gray ground about what someone's responsibilities are when they're dealing with a sexual predator, when dealing with themselves. So hopefully because of that, and because it's being distributed by Neon, I know Neon doesn't have the best track record for distributing films and like getting wide audiences, but hopefully, you know, it ends up in theaters, makes a bit of money, and ends up on a streamer where it's going to find an audience.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on to our next movie, and that is The Teacher's Lounge. New to her school, Miss Novak is reluctantly drawn into the interrogation of two grade six class representatives after a series of thefts. They cast suspicion on a Turkish classmate, Ali, despite his proclamation of innocence, even after a search turns up a surprisingly fat wallet. Convinced racism is at play, the teacher decides to set up a sting operation to uncover the true culprit. So at the beginning of this episode, I mentioned how one of the movies is going to be a little bit difficult to talk about, and that's this movie, because so much of this film is, you know, a Rachel word is vibes. And I would say that this movie is about the vibes and not in a good way at all. It was so interesting. I watched this movie mostly on the recommendation from Jeff Bulmer of Classic Movies Live. He said it was the best thing that he saw at TIFF, and he watched 40 movies at TIFF. So I was like, all right, well, you know, if he watched 40 movies and some really high profile ones, I saw the list that he saw, and he was on the podcast and talked about all the things that he loved. And I was like, all right, well, that's a recommendation and a half for me. So that's why I went. And I didn't really know what to expect. And I came out of that movie so anxious and such a ball of nerves. Like, I thought like I had just, you know, gone through hell and back myself. And it was funny. So afterwards, the movie ended, met out front with my wife, and we were going to go see Evil Does Not Exist. And a movie that you were there for as well. And I tried talking to her. I was like, I couldn't form complete sentences. I didn't know how to talk. I was so stressed out. Did you end up having such a visceral reaction to this movie that I did, or am I sort of an outlier?
I don't know if you are an outlier. I work with small children for a living. I did not leave this movie as much of a ball of nerves as you, but I think I'm predisposed to the exact brand of like anxiety that this is getting at, which is just like a children are difficult and also kind of fully cognizant and capable like people, in that they're able to conjure up, manipulate, and benefit off of situations as well, as just as well as adults are. And this movie has both like adults and kids kind of operating at super anxiety producing levels. I thought this movie was very good. I did not leave with Uncut Gems level stress like you did, though. So that is me.
See, for me, the Uncut Gems level stress was more just like frustration. As much as I love the movie, I absolutely adore Uncut Gems, it was the frustration of like, how can he keep making bad decision after bad decision, where us as the audience go, no, don't do that. Now this is the shit that you have to deal with. You have to reap what you sow, because you are purposely putting yourselves in a position to make these bad decisions. Whereas in the Teacher's Lounge, I'll sort of expand on the plot a little bit more. This, you know, this theft is sort of the start of it, but then the teacher has belief that maybe it was someone on the school staff that is maybe doing these petty thieves, because she sees a fellow teacher steal money out of the communal coffee fund. And so what she does is she notices that she's got a bunch of money in her wallet. So she leaves her jacket with the wallet in it in the staff room and leaves her computer laptop open and hits record. And then through this, we see someone. It's not 100% clear, but it's clear enough of who we believe steals her money. And so the line is sort of drawn. Maybe this person was also responsible for stealing money from the children or things like that. And then it becomes this, you know, issue of zero tolerance policy. So this person gets put on leave. And then, unfortunately, this person also has a student in Ms. Novak's classroom. So this child is then now the center of accusations because they're led to believe that it is like parent, like child, that you are exactly the same. You inherit the same tendencies. So this kid is accused of being a thief as well. And then you've got the kid sort of ganging up on him, but then also ganging up on the teacher. And then the parents have like a parent-teacher night, and they all have like a WhatsApp group where they can share messages. So accusations are flying at this teacher because this parent is involved. And then you have the fellow teachers who don't know the full story about how this person was caught. And like, I'm explaining a lot, and it's probably not going to make sense to anyone who has not seen this movie, but there's so much going on. At any given point, the idea of what's the right thing to do and what isn't, how much can you say and shouldn't say, how much should you be correcting the record versus, you know, not getting in the middle of things. That's where the stress came from me. Whereas, you know, compared to Uncut Gems, it was the purposely bad decisions. Whereas this, it was like, every situation was a no-win scenario, no matter which way the teacher decided to go for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that in that way, I definitely can see where your frustration is so kind of rampant. I obviously very much felt the same frustration. It's hard not to feel that frustration. It is a intentionally frustrating movie. I think though maybe my frustration was and anxiety was diffused because I think that there is such a rich text of a movie. I think this, it says so much in its metaphor about society and tyranny and democracy and trustworthiness and misinformation and all of these major themes. And it is, I think, obviously not the first time that a filmmaker or any artist actually has used the schoolhouse as a representation of a larger society. But I think it is done particularly well here in terms of especially the kind of evils and or nefarious activities that are ever so present in society. This does not, there is no light metaphor in this movie. There's no like, and here's a good thing. It's just purely anxiety, frustration, and the kind of terrors of modern society and of teaching small children.
Yeah, I think I'm very interested because I watched this movie, I came out of it, and I was like, I feel like this is a movie that is an allegory for the Gestapo of Nazi Germany. And this is a German film. So right off the bat, that's sort of where my connection goes. And so you've got these, you know, different classes of people between, you know, the teachers and then the students. And so there are different levels of justice and things like that. And the way rumors are spread and forced interrogations of the children where they're made to go, the teachers go through their wallets to look for money. You've got like this sort of all-seeing WhatsApp group where they can discuss things and spread rumors and lies and all that sort of thing without knowing what's actually going on. There's this sequence where the school newspaper, which is run independently by the children, do a smear campaign on the teacher, all this sort of stuff. And I was talking about it with Jeff Ballmer, who had saw it at TIFF as well, and he said even a little subtle thing like the person who steals the money from the teacher's wallet. Did you notice on the person's shirt was covered in gold stars, which also sort of like, as soon as he said that, I was that like fired all the synapses in my brain. I was like, this is exactly what this movie is about.
Yeah.
From what I understand, the filmmakers are fully fine with people drawing their own conclusions about what the film means. As well as far as allegories and things like that. They apparently did not intend to set out to make it an allegory for, you know, Nazi-era Germany, but they are totally aware of why people will come to that conclusion and are fine with people making that connection. So much so that even the teacher, she's actually Polish. So I think that added another layer as well, too.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy that they didn't set out to. Maybe they didn't initially, but at some point in making this movie, they had to realize what they were doing. That's the allegory is so obviously there. It's so obvious.
Yeah. That's it. 5 stars. I really hope people see this. I believe it was put forward for Germany's submission for the best international film at the Oscars. So if it does get a nomination, I know people will be able to see it then. But hopefully it does get an audience because it is so good.
Yeah, I agree. It'd be a really cool nomination.
All right. And then the last film that we want to talk about is The Zone of Interest. Hedwig Hoss, mother of 5 and wife to Rudolph, live in an idyllic villa. A river running alongside the bucolic garden, literally a stone's throw from Rudolph's place of work. He's a camp commandant at Auschwitz. Hedwig's concerns are domestic, and most of the film takes place within the home. So, I think it is very, very important to note that this film does deal with the Holocaust and the fact that the main character in this film works at Auschwitz and all that stuff. But the problem is not even a problem. The way this film is set up is we never see inside the camp once. We never see the suffering of Jewish people or anyone else that was murdered at the concentration camps. This film is basically entirely a family drama where the husband is dealing with the bureaucracy of work and the wife is dealing with maintaining a home because she is the partner of a high-ranking official, so she has to do lots of entertaining. And so I know this movie is going to put off a lot of people in terms of, you know, if you're dealing with the Holocaust and subject matter that is very serious and grim, you don't want to witness these atrocities, but you have to understand that the characters know the weight of what is going on. In this film, I don't want to say it's not interested in it because it very specifically chooses to make the focus on these people and the banality of evil. And it's a hard movie to describe without sounding callous, but that said, it is so fascinating to watch. It's directed by Jonathan Glazer, who did Under the Skin, and this is his first movie since Under the Skin a decade ago, and is a very eagerly awaited return for people. It's completely in German, and I think people are going to have a bit of time accessing some of the subject matter, but that said, I think it is so fascinating, and I know you and I, we saw this one together as well. When the movie finished, you and I stayed sitting in our seats while the rest of our group had kind of started to leave already. And I feel like we just kind of had to sit there, as you do in like movies like this, where you just sort of have to sit there in your thoughts while the credits are playing and being like, all right, what do I think about this movie? What happened? How do I feel about all this? And I really appreciate that you and I kind of just sat there and sort of like sat in silence, where I think I really needed that moment of digestion to happen.
That moment where we got to sit together and kind of just digest the film, that didn't leave me. I kept doing that as I drove home. It was one of those rare instances where I drove home in kind of just complete silence and thought. It's heavy. It's a heavy movie. It's centered around some people that are definitely truly evil. It's also a boring movie. It's an unsettling movie. It's confident in what it's trying to say, and it forces you to be on the same page as it. Whether or not you land on that same page and the movie connects with you is up to each viewer, obviously, but it does not relinquish any of its self-confidence stylistically or thematically or in the actual content on the screen itself. It is very sure of itself, and it shows a side to the Holocaust that I had never encountered, and not one that you're supposed to, I think, encounter. Definitely not one that's like taught in the histories of like, here, sit with these people for a couple hours. So yeah, a really profound work.
Yeah, it's tough because like I don't want to say that the main characters are sympathetic in any way. And I think, you using the adjective boring is a very interesting one, because it's not boring in the sense of like, oh man, I kept checking my watch, when will this movie end, boring. It's boring in the sense of it's absolutely mundane in the day-to-day activities that we are witnessing happening. You know, early on, there's this scene where Rudolph is sitting with two salesmen and they're showing him these blueprints and talking about what they're trying to sell. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, I do have money for expansion. I am going to, you know, talk to the upper brass, all this sort of stuff, where it's just like such the most bland bureaucratic sales talk you'll ever hear, except for what they're talking about is a more efficient gas chamber that they are trying to sell to the Germans to build to more effectively kill people. And it's like when you're listening to them talk, you know, like, oh yes, and this is the blueprint for this, and this is room one, and this is room two, and this is how it works and operates, and you have your men doing this and your other men doing that, and then while you're doing that, you just load people in, and it's just so boring and mundane that it's absolutely horrifying. And Jonathan Glazer has, I don't know what his balls are made of to make this movie where he is so knowingly at any given point never makes the main characters look bad at all, is such a choice that I don't think I've ever seen anything like this done before or will ever be done again.
I agree. I think it's a very singular work. That's a really good way of putting it. I don't know how he had the gall to make this movie. I don't think a movie like it can be made again for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think that people are going to have the audacity to do it, but also they would immediately get the comparison to the Zone of Interest. So I think it will stand as a singular film in that way, and that it can only kind of be made once in this manner. But mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, it's, there's not a lot of despicable things shown on screen in this movie. Like there's, in terms of like on screen evil, there's not a lot of it.
No,
there's a little fidelity, like
some background. Yeah.
Yeah. We get some background. We get people talking about evil things. We get a little infidelity that happens mostly off screen. We see a brother lock his brother in a greenhouse. I'm like, that's pretty evil. But otherwise, it's a lot of chores and mundane things. And Sandra Hüller and her dog, again, much like Anatomy of a Fall. So, yeah, it's... And yet it is so profoundly disturbing. It is so disturbing.
Yeah. And like even the stuff of like the brother locking his other brother in a greenhouse, we're like, that's just typical kid stuff where the older brother, the older sibling kind of, you know, being a bit cruel in a teasing manner to their younger sibling. That's just so routine and normal that like anyone that has siblings, whether you're the older or younger one, experienced that growing up or have seen it in other movies or things like that. And there's nothing like especially nefarious in it other than the fact that the older brother is wearing his Hitler Youth uniform, which, mm-hmm. you know, definitely adds a layer of like, oh, you know, if the war wasn't about to end in a year or two after this movie takes place, I definitely know what this kid's future is.
Yep.
And it's sort of like Anatomy of a Fall, where I feel like Justine Triet sort of, you know, missed the mark on putting her stamp on making it unique. I think Jonathan Glazer really sort of nailed the unique aspects. There's a couple scenes where it's shown in negative, as in like there's no color. It looks like a photo negative. And you're left kind of wondering what's going on. It's sort of this like heat vision negative color aspect to it, where there's two scenes of it. In the first scene, I was so confused at what was happening. And then the second time it happened, I understand exactly what it was. And then there's also, you know, the movie starts with this overture where for, you know, I think it's like 2 or 3 minutes, it was just a black screen and this music is playing. And then also like, there's another part about 3/4 of the movie where the screen just goes bright red for a few moments and then goes back. And so there's these, all these very interesting flourishes that Glazer has added into this film where you can't even critique of like, oh, you know, he's just trying to be sympathetic or whatever. No, this is someone who's fully in control of his craft and knows exactly what he's doing, is being very deliberate about every single choice he's making.
Yeah, I have to say the intro and the outro, for that matter, and the red interstitial, I think about that red one a lot because I think it really dislodged me from the comfort of knowing what was happening in the movie, of like where we were supposed to be situated and where Jonathan Glazer was going to take us. It just keeps you fully on your toes. And I think about that all the time. I think it's a very strong stylistic choice. I wasn't the biggest fan of the kind of photo negative heat vision sequences, but they definitely serve a purpose. Whether or not I'm on board with that purpose, I have to say, like, I commend Jonathan Glazer for executing upon that vision. And I think this is one of the best directed movies I've seen in probably the last few years. It's incredibly well made in that way. And whether or not every part of it works for somebody, or if any of it works for somebody, is obviously up to them. But it is a remarkably commendable film. And I think just because of that, it is my favorite of the fest in a like pure respect sense.
I totally get where you're coming from. And yeah, this is definitely going to be a movie that is not for everyone. I think some of the stylistic choices are going to confuse people. I think the perspective that this film takes is going to throw people off, and that they're going to have a very visceral negative reaction to it. And then I think there's going to be some people that absolutely adore it. And I think that so far, this is probably the best directed film of the year, even if not everything absolutely works for me, kind of what you were saying. The direction I cannot argue with at all. And I think one sort of very interesting tidbit is, for anyone that might think that the film is, how do I say it? Predatory, or I don't know what adjective to use. It's very interesting that Glazer actually got permission. This film was shot right next to Auschwitz. And in the end, there's a sequence that takes place in Auschwitz, the only time that we see inside the concentration camp. And so the fact that I know that he got full cooperation from the Polish government, and you watch the credits, everyone's name in this movie, other than the cast that are German, this is like a complete Polish production, which is very fascinating to see that people are on board with the type of story that he is wanting to tell. And I think that sort of speaks a lot of volumes to the length that ensuring that the subject matter, that the people whose lives are actually affected, were consulted and agreed upon this film.
I agree. I think it's pretty remarkable that the dividends also get to kind of go back to the Polish community. That was obviously the most scarred by the like the pure and like physical existence of Auschwitz. So
yeah.
And you and I sat there, and that was really one of the only things we talked about. But in terms of like a non like, wow, we're sitting with our emotions. But as like we were watching the credits roll, we were like, these are all Polish names. Like every name up there is a Polish name. So
yeah. And then sort of the last thing I want to say about this is, interestingly enough, Poland did not select this movie as their submission to the Oscars. I don't know what was going on, but England was a co-producer of this film. And so this is the UK's entrant into the Best International Film Oscars. And at this point, I think it has to be the front runner to win.
I would agree. I'm not sure what else would compete with it. I know, obviously, that this lost out on the Palme d'Or to Anatomy of a Fall, but I think, as was noted on our preview podcast, Anatomy of a Fall was not selected by the French government to be their submission to the Academy Awards. So it certainly can't lose to Anatomy of a Fall in that category again. But yeah, otherwise, I'm not sure what's going to run up against it. All the other international films I've seen this year, I think in terms of what would appeal to Oscar audiences, kind of pale in comparison. So it'll be interesting. This will be a movie that we will surely come back to and talk about, not just over the course of the next few months or and year end lists and Oscar races, but I think in the years to come, it kind of felt like an instantly canonical work. So it is a hell of a movie, and I implore people to see it on the big screen so that they can give it their full attention without even the chance of a phone or a second screen of any kind to distract them, because this is a work that is necessary for you to sit in. So
yeah,
that would be my final thought.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap things up here. Do you have any honorable mentions of movies you just want to give a very quick shout out to, of ones that people should have on their radar or worth checking out?
The only movie I would put on people's radar that might not already be on their radars is a movie called Red Rooms. This is a Canadian film by Pascal Plante, who it's his third feature. His last feature, Nadia Butterfly, was not a movie I particularly enjoyed. And I did not have the gall to tell him that, because he was at the screening of Red Rooms. And this is a fantastic, also courtroom drama in French, although it's French Canadian. So it's like slightly different. It doesn't exactly compete with Anatomy of a Fall. But this movie is really good. I don't know what its wide release is going to be. I have no idea what its distribution is going to be like, you know, quote unquote overseas, even if that's just in America. But if people can see Red Rooms, I really implore them to. It's a fantastic kind of like psycho thriller courtroom drama. One of probably the biggest surprise for me at this festival.
Nice. Yeah, that one wasn't really on my radar, but I know that you are a fan of it, so it definitely is going to be one that I'm going to try to seek out myself. As for me, my honorable mentions, I'm going to shout three very quickly out. Evil Does Not Exist, which was the new Ryusuke Hamaguchi film. He did Drive My Car. If anyone was, you know, put off by the 3-hour runtime, Evil Does Not Exist is an hour 45, so it's a much more palatable runtime. Very excellent. And I feel like we were going to talk about the ending, because we came out of this movie being like, what the hell did we just watch? What does this ending mean? And on the way home, my wife and I were talking about it, and I want to have a discussion about it. But this podcast is not the platform to do that, so we'll have to find another time to talk about it.
Yeah.
The next one, Monster, the only movie that I found that topped the Teacher's Lounge for me. Both are 5-star films. Monster is the new Hirokazu Koreeda film, who did Shoplifters, which won the Palme d'Or a few years ago and was nominated for Best International Film. He also did Broker, another film I was very high on. I'm not as familiar with his earlier stuff. He's a big blind spot for his early career, but I highly, highly recommend this one. You watch it the first 45 minutes, you're like, what is this movie? I don't get it. And then in typical Koreeda fashion, he just absolutely breaks your heart. And then the last one is Mr. Dress-Up, The Magic of Make-Believe, which is a documentary about Mr. Dress-Up. So if you are Canadian, you probably, and you're of a certain age, you grew up with Mr. Dress-Up. He was on the air for 30 years up until the mid to late 90s, I believe, and still exists on reruns on CBC. But a very fascinating documentary about how he got his start. He actually came up to Canada with Mr. Rogers. He's not actually Canadian, he's American. Came up with Mr. Rogers and then sort of was able to have his own brand of children's entertainment, and will make you relive your childhood and get very dusty in however you watch this movie. It will make you tear up a little bit. But those are three movies I want to highlight as well. But Todd, I really want to thank you for coming on today. It is always a pleasure. I super appreciate you having these discussions with me and being a great VIF buddy with me, because we sat together so many times this past week and a half, 2 weeks.
Of course. I wish it wasn't Canadian Thanksgiving and everyone was so busy this weekend, because I know we would have gotten at least a couple more in. And but we will in the future. And I know I'll be back to maybe talk about some movies that we don't pretty much fully see eye to eye on. Maybe I'll make you watch Face Off.
You're after Rachel's heart with that one.
Rachel and I, one of these days, we're just going to find enough people to just kind of like crowd around you and bully you into watching Face Off. And then we get to have a contentious podcast.
I feel like I already get that enough from online, but yeah, sure, let's definitely have people bully me to watch this movie. Where can people find more of your work, and have you been able to write anything yet, or do you have anything coming out about VIF?
I have some capsule reviews on the way. People can find my work at For Real, which I'm sure you'll link. They can follow me on social media at Todd_Complex. That's Twitter, Letterboxd, probably most social media. And yeah, that's me. Go Braves. This is a big Braves podcast.
Only because the Jays have now been eliminated.
He's going to cut this. He's like, absolutely is getting cut.
Well, I have several reviews already posted, so make sure you check out contrazoompod.com to read them. By the time this podcast comes out, I will hopefully have published an article about the best films I saw at VIFF along with my own awards, so I'll link to that in the show notes if it's out. And also, as a preview for next week's episode, it will be an interview one. I talked to Caitlin Sponheimer, the director of Wild Goat Surf, and Olga Petza, an actress from I Used to Be Funny. So make sure you stay tuned for that episode. And the rest of the awards are also being announced in a couple of days, so I'll comment on them on next week's show as well. This has been a That Shelf podcast. Visit thatshelf.com for more great film discourse. Follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at ContraZoomPod. What movies did you see at VIFF at all? What are you excited about that came out that you really want to see? Send an email to ContraZoomPod@gmail.com. Thank you to Eric and Kevin Smale for the theme music and to Stephanie Pryor for the logo design. If you like to listen to podcasts on YouTube, we do post all episodes there as well. And if you really like the show, consider tipping us on Ko-fi. Thanks for checking us out.